Morning, everyone. Let's just pray before we start. Open our ears, O Lord, to hear your word and know your voice. Speak to our hearts and strengthen our wills, that we may serve you now and always. Amen. Okay, well, I think I got the short straw going through the book of Daniel. I've been challenged this week. Actually, and if you want to hear this more of the story, I can tell you. But my thinking was definitely put to the test. So we come to the less well-known and decidedly more daunting bit of the book of Daniel. We couldn't read the whole chapter, sadly, but sort of picked out the main bits, I think. And I see that for those of you in the Baptist Church who are following with your groups, you're not actually going to go any further into the apocalyptic book of Daniel, certainly for this bit. But the second half of Daniel is quite interesting and very otherworldly, shall we say. Some of you might remember back to the first week when you saw the overview video on YouTube, which is really, really good, actually. It's well worth the watch if you haven't seen it. Bible Project do overviews of all the books of the Bible. And it consists of a series of visions. First of all, dreams from Nebuchadnezzar, but the latter half, which Daniel 7 is the start, are visions of Daniel's. And they're very complex in nature, very alien to us, and often far from clear as to their meaning at first. And even if you go into them, it's difficult to quite know what's going on. Scholars debate, more fanciful minds revel in speculation and get quite obsessed with it all. But most of us, as ordinary readers, tend to just quickly skip those bits. We all love the stories at the beginning of Daniel, but the apocalyptic parts are a bit beyond us, and we might find ourselves just quickly skimming through those. But we have to remember it's been part of God's word for many centuries and is able to instruct us for our salvation. So we have to take them seriously and look at them a bit more closely, which is what I've done this week. And I hope what I offer to you this morning is of help to you in that. So first of all, a little bit of background, a little bit of sort of spotting things. In fact, Belshazzar wasn't a king, so there's a little bit of an anomaly there. And then this chapter isn't actually in time order in Daniel, with the rest of the beginning of Daniel. And you might have noticed when he talks at the beginning of Belshazzar. Well, in fact, Belshazzar was killed off in chapter 5. After the incident with the handwriting on the wall. So this is obviously chapter 7. Darius the Mede, who's mentioned in chapter 6, he's a bit of a shadowy figure. We don't really know very much about him historically, but he would have been in power after Belshazzar. So whoever he was, that bit of historical context there is a bit blurry. So it's not at all. It happens after before chapters 5 and 6. So that can get a little bit confusing. It's placed right in the middle of the prophetic writings in our version of the Old Testament. It's different in the Hebrew Bible. But with that in mind, I did want to talk a bit about the importance of differentiating between prophetic writings and apocalyptic writings. So just bear with me. They're not the same. And yes, you do get a bit of apocalyptic writing in the prophets. You might remember Isaiah 6, where he sees God on his throne and an angel comes down and puts coals on his lips. A very strange story. That's very apocalyptic sounding imagery, but prophetic utterances are quite different to that. They have a different purpose and a focus on different things. So prophets pass judgment on events and actions in specific moments in the political and religious life of the people of Israel. And we often look at that as by an extension, they speak to us also. whereas apocalyptic writings pass judgment on the whole of history. It's got a much more sweeping remit. Prophets speak out against particular injustices and ethical struggles in Israel that they know of. They are part of that situation. They see happening in their lifetimes. But in contrast, apocalypses, to use the technical word for more than one, much more generalized and almost exclusively use symbols, as symbolic visions of the reign of evil and the coming of judgment in the end times. They usually have a divine messenger that comes down and explains what's going on. And it's usually way out of our usual frame of reference. That happens in chapter 5 of Revelation, chapter 7. So the messenger explaining is quite a common thing in these writings. In prophecy, Israel is judged for their misdeeds, and the consequences are identified quite clearly. However, in apocalyptic scenario, judgment will be a final cataclysm. It'll be like the meteor heading for Earth in the movie Armageddon. And the whole of the earth will be affected, and judgment will sweep through the nations, and nothing can stop it. Another aspect of prophecy is that there's an option to change your activities or your behavior, the way you live, in order to avoid the consequences prophesied about. Most of the prophets are focused on telling Israel that they've gone away from God and that they need to turn back, otherwise something will happen. And as we saw in Daniel, the beginning, they didn't turn back, and so they ended up in exile. The prophecies came true. Their country was destroyed, and the cream of their society, intellectuals and young people, all ended up in Babylon. But again, by contrast, the apocalyptic writing doesn't do that. The end will come suddenly after evil forces are beaten, and that's it. That's the end. God will intervene in the full scope of history in his timing when he's ready, and we won't have any control over or knowledge of when that will be. The end will come and human beings will suffer the consequences or enjoy the consequences. So there are two kinds of foreseeing there. There's one where you have control over your life and how you live it and the consequences follow on from that, and the one where you just have to watch in awe and wonder at what's going on and trust God for his mercy and goodness and promises, his promises. So looking at this chapter this week, well, the last couple of weeks actually, the apocalyptic writings to me, and this chapter in particular, seem to have an almost exclusive political focus. And everyone goes, ugh, politics. The beasts are seen as representing kingdoms and empires. The visions are always to do with human political entities and powers. And so this is what I feel God wants me to highlight to you today. I felt it very strongly after my wrestling with the text. But before I go into that any further, I'd like us to have a look at Daniel's first vision. And I don't know whether in the future you're going to be looking at the later chapters of Daniel, maybe after a break. But in the course of my looking for this today, I've learned quite a lot about the different symbols, what they mean. And so I'd like to share with you a few clues I've found as to the symbolism that some scholars use in decoding the apocalyptic writings. But before I share my screen with some pictures, I just want to talk about the first thing Daniel describes. And we didn't quite get the idea of the corners of the earth from Penny's reading, but that's just different translations. The four winds of the heaven stirring up the sea. Now, Daniel would have been steeped in ancient scriptures, and so he'll be thinking of the waters of chaos in Genesis 1. In fact, that you may well have thought of that yourself. And also the waters of the Red Sea parting for the Israelites. There are so many possibilities for this imagery, but the four winds are commonly seen as representing the four corners of the earth, north, south, east, and west. And it can also make us think again of the Spirit of God moving on the water, so that the vision takes us back to the beginning of time and history, and where it went to after human beings went their own way from the Garden of Eden. And this is where these kingdoms are going to come from. Going to come from human beings not living as God intended them to. It also reinforces the idea that this is a global thing, north, south, east, west, it's over all the earth. There's no part of the earth that's free of these consequences of people going their own way. It covers the whole earth, and we can see from history ourselves that that's true. And Daniel's distress has been echoed down the ages as well. And it's not surprising that all his experience of serving different rulers in high office, he had four different bosses in his lifetime, he would have become more and more aware of the demonic potential for evil lurking behind all systems of human control. And I'm sure we could all name a few instances of these kinds of kingdoms existing down through the ages. The surprise then is that actually Daniel stays in the business he's in. But we'll come back to that a bit later. So let's just go, I'm just going to screen share. Here we have the four beasts in Daniel 7. I've started with this. We can see the pictures of the hybrid creatures. And as you can see, they're all very menacing. They're all larger than life, and they're all very powerful beings. Obviously, this is an artist's impression, one artist's impression, but certainly how Daniel describes them in his book. And you can see the lists of their attributes at the side there. We're not looking at something like My Little Pony type creatures. We're going to be imagining monsters that ravage the earth, Godzilla-like things. Some scholars say that these hybrid creatures are borrowed from Babylonian imagery, which is quite understandable as Daniel was, you know, well gone in that culture. Other scholars talk about the predatory nature of these beasts, so they can be interpreted as code for the dangerous empires they represent. And I think we could probably understand that idea quite readily. They can also be seen as hideous combinations that kind of demonstrate the opposite of God's orderly and beautiful creation, moving away from God's perfect creation. And that as people's disobedience continue, things get more and more hideous and combinations come together that are not natural and not part of the order of things. What happens when God's ways are not followed? And this is on a political scale, global. Terrifying creatures. Out of that. Well, I keep talking about politics, and I'm afraid that for me is what stood out when I was reading this in other chapters. We go back to Nebuchadnezzar's dream with the statue we talked about a couple of weeks ago. That signified very clearly the four empires, if you remember from Johnny's talk, that's right, last week. And it's all about what the states are doing, how the politics is being run, what powerful people are doing to take over other people's lives. It's not really about the lives of individuals. It's about nations and powers. And I think it's interesting because Daniel works hard for the powers that he is part of. And that is something we have to remember too. He was a faithful servant to the powers that he served. And there are many verses in the Bible that remind us to obey those in authority, pay our taxes and follow the laws, pray for those who govern us. Daniel sees in his dream what happens when people break the covenant with God big time. This is not wishy-washy stuff. This is what happens. We can think about it on an individual level and how awful our lives can get when we're not looking to God to follow his ways. But when you expand that out to communities, nations, and empires, then we get something altogether more terrible. But Daniel also sees hope in the judgment of the Ancient of Days. And we mustn't become despairing, because there will be a judgment and the coming of the Son of Man. And incidentally, Daniel's the only place, apart from the Gospels in the Bible, where this phrase is used. And Jesus uses that title in all the Gospels about himself. And in my version, it was 78 times he calls himself the Son of Man. So we can see very clearly a very strong link between Daniel and the Son of Man coming at the end of time. So let's carry on. So common symbols in apocalyptic writings. So eyes equal knowledge. Just going to do this very quickly. White hair stands for eternity or majesty. Hands are for power. Legs for stability. No idea how hard I had finding an image for that one. Lions are for royalty. Oxes are for strength. Horns, as some of you will know, power. And there's more than 10 horns there, I think. Sea monsters. Well, the depth of the sea, the abyss, was always something in Hebrew thinking that contained evil. So sea monsters always denote evil. And it's a funny little corollary with the story of the madman who Jesus healed. The demons ask him not to send them into the abyss. And so Jesus doesn't, kind of plays a little trick on them, because he sends them into the pigs, doesn't he? And then what do the pigs do? They run into the sea. So the demons end up in the abyss anyway. For Jewish people, that would be a very powerful image. A lamb denotes sacrifice. The wings of a bird, there's a couple of creatures, aren't there, with wings, denote agility. And then the colours. So white is for victory, purity and joy. Red for bloodshed and martyrdom. And black is for death. Clothing, a crown, your pictures are all over the top of my PowerPoint. So clothing, the crown equals kingly status, but long robes, we look out for long robes because they denote priestly status. And then the numbers. So as we saw before, 4 is the corners of the earth. 7 in Hebrew thinking was perfection. 12, obviously the 12 tribes of Israel. So that's the people of Israel. And then 1,000. So if you get 10,000, then, you know, that's in their minds, that was, you know, whole millions and millions of people. So 1,000 is a multitude. So hopefully these things will give you some sort of clues if you ever do sort of have a read of the rest of Daniel or Revelation, have a look at Revelation. It helps you to think more deeply about the visions and the images that are being talked about there that don't seem to make an awful lot of sense to us today. So coming back, to the political side of things then. Looking at these beasts, as I mentioned earlier, people have spent years trying to understand the symbolism and the meanings, and book after book's been written about when it all might happen. What do they really mean? Which kingdoms are they referring to? What's going to actually happen to these kingdoms? And how long have we got to wait until Jesus comes back? People get so caught up in this side of things, I think. We need to be very careful not to get too bogged down in the details. Yes, it's good to be interested in these things. And as I say, you need to look at the overall picture. I think for me today, the message I wanted to get across is that God is interested in politics, in earthly kingdoms, cultures and societies. He's not just looking at us individually, the God that we serve. He is a God of community, very much so. He is a community himself. There's three of them. He's a God of nations. He acts in history, nations and cultures, and we can be assured by that. Jesus came into our world at a particular time in history, quite a volatile time in history, in fact, to a particular place, quite a volatile place, actually, which had been invaded by one of the powers that was part of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, if you remember, Romans. And his death was a political act as much as a religious one. Pilate could have set him free, but for political reasons, he washed his hands of him and told the Jews to do what they liked with him. So we cannot count out politics. We cannot not be interested in politics. I'm sorry to have to say this to people who find politics difficult or distressing or just boring. God will have the final word over the kingdoms of this world. We often think of judgment as an unpleasant thing for us all, but would we want the atrocities perpetrated down the ages to just be ignored and swept under the carpet? Or do we want them to be properly judged and proper actions taken to right those wrongs? God's judgment will be about equity, mercy, and the righting of wrongs for all eternity. And if we look at what the four beasts do and have the potential to do, it's not surprising that God is going to come and judge that. And we want that, don't we? Where would we be if we didn't have that hope of wrongs being put right? So we can be encouraged that God has a plan for his world, despite how it looks on the world stage sometimes, and especially at the moment. We have to bear our part too, though. There are many things we cannot do to influence world events, and we often see things happening all around us that can lead us to give up and despair. But when we read Daniel, we see that although he despaired too, he saw God's actions, he saw God coming, and he knew that there would be a resolution to this, and that these creatures would be destroyed. And he continued with his duties in captivity. He could have gone back to Israel. In fact, there were groups of people who were allowed back to Israel during Daniel's lifetime, and he could have gone back, but he chose to stay in Babylon and to serve his political masters, and he died there. So let's be aware of what's going on around us in the political and social arena. In 2 Peter 3:11 and 12, it says, "What sort of persons ought you to be in leading lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God?" The instruction here is for us to do our part. We have things to do, and it will ultimately affect when the ending happens. How incredible is that? Being aware and getting involved doesn't have to be on a massive scale. We can think locally, our parish or town or county councillors. We can think of who our councillors are and pray for them. We can keep informed of what's happening locally and see where we can be involved. I mean, many of you are involved in social justice things, and it can sometimes feel like they were screaming into the abyss of need and justice in this world. But if we do, then we have to come back to God and ask him to lay specific things on our hearts. Ask him to bring them to our mind and put us in the way of others with the same goals and aims. So don't ever get so bogged down that you can't. But we can't bury our heads in the sand as Christians. We can wait for the day of reckoning in our cozy little fellowships, but we're called to something more than that. We're called to be active and alert, not obsessed, not too heavenly minded to be any earthly use. But we must be looking for what God is doing and joining in our local community as much as we can, especially at these times. It's difficult, isn't it? But we can all do something, even if, and I won't say just praying, even if it is praying. We can't take it all on our shoulders, but we must always cling to the bedrock of our faith in Jesus and his coming again. So I feel like I've just scratched the surface of Daniel's apocalyptic writings for you today. And I do hope it's been helpful for you and your discussions later in the week. As I say, I had my thinking challenged by some of the, it was a very good thing for that to happen to me this in the course of this. I've found different kinds of opinions with scholars of the books and commentaries I was reading, and I had to really wrestle with some of the things that were being said. So I would, and it's a really good exercise to do that. You can have your mind changed, or you can decide and you'd be stronger in what you believed at the beginning. So another little thing I would say, just come as a, on a personal note, read widely. If you're investigating passages in the Bible, read widely and be challenged. Look to God to challenge you in your thinking and your, you know, where you think he's taking you. He always will challenge you if you're looking at his word in any kind of depth. But I would just, it was a really good experience for me. And I would, you know, just say, make sure you read different. Don't just go back to your normal little commentaries or YouTube videos, you know, read widely. So yeah, another little takeaway I wanted to share with you.